From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now. The unrest in Israel is escalating today. That is the sound of Israeli Arabs and Jews clashing on the streets in the city of Lod. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has warned against the violence and has described the neighborhood attacks as lynchings. Meanwhile, Israel has escalated its military campaign, bombing another apartment tower in Gaza as Palestinian militants continue to lob rockets at Israeli cities. CNN's Ben Wiedemann joins us now for the latest. He is in Lod, outside the capital, Tel Aviv. Ben, welcome.
My pleasure.
And this is no longer just rocket fire that we're dealing with. The violence is spilling into the streets between civilians. What exactly are you seeing there in Lod?
Oh, here we're in Lod, or Lid, as it's called in Arabic. It's a mixed Palestinian-Israeli and Jewish-Israeli town. And what we're seeing is that there is a very large police presence. There's an overnight curfew from 8 p.m. to 4 a.m. that's been imposed for the last two nights. In front of me, I'm looking at two burned-out cars down the street from here. There's a school that's been partially burned. A lot of the houses are showing broken glass and other signs of damage. And the situation is very tense. These are neighborhoods where Jews and Palestinians live in the same apartment building, and I was speaking to one Jewish resident of this neighborhood who told me that until recently the relations between the two communities was fairly good, normal, but because of the tensions in Gaza, the tensions in Jerusalem, communal relations have soured dramatically. Nights before last, there were fights in the street around her house, and she decided it just wasn't safe, and she went to live for a few nights with her mother in Jerusalem. And Palestinian-Israeli residents here will tell you of frictions between not necessarily the Jewish inhabitants of this town, but rather the people who come from outside who are stoking tensions here in the town. But regardless of what the perspective is, there is a lot of tension.
What are the casualties you've seen? How many?
Well, here in Lod itself, there's only been one person killed, a Palestinian who was shot the Monday night. In turn, it's more really just sort of really communal violence, not involving armed groups. They're having clashes with the police. Now, in terms of the broader conflict, we're talking about more than 80 Palestinians killed in Gaza and seven Israelis killed in the last few days. Basically, we're talking since Monday this is happening. I've been here for many previous wars and periods of tension, but I've never seen an escalation at this speed, at this rate of acceleration that really is indicative of something worse to come.
Well, Israel now appears to be amassing troops and tanks at the Gaza border. Do you see signs that this is about to move into something more severe, into a ground operation?
It is pointing in that direction. There are two call-ups for reserves, and they moved tanks down to that area. Now, I was hearing on Al Arabiya, an Arabic news channel, saying that the Egyptians have offered the Israelis to convey demands between Hamas and Israel. And according to Al Arabiya, the Israelis turned down the offer. Indications are from Israeli officials that they have a goal they want to achieve, which is essentially smashing Hamas's ability to launch rockets into Israel. And until that goal is achieved, they appear to be determined to carry on. Having said that, Peter, it should be pointed out that this is a cycle. I can't tell you how many times I've seen this happen before. Fundamentally, there's a problem here that it's not Hamas. It's the situation here that diplomats have tried for decades to resolve. And until that's resolved, this is going to happen again and again and again. Peter.
So when you speak with civilians there on the streets in Lod, what is the sense? Is there a feeling that this is headed to an all-out war?
Well, you need to differentiate between the Palestinians in Gaza, Palestinians in Jerusalem, and we're talking here in Lod or Lid, these are all Israelis. This is a problem Israel has to sort out by itself. The general feeling, whether you're talking to people in the West Bank, Jerusalem, Gaza, or where I am, is that the situation is escalating, and there don't seem to be many feet on the brakes. The people are bracing for much worse.
CNN senior international correspondent Ben Wiedemann reporting there on the streets of the Israeli city of Lod. Thank you very much for speaking with us. Appreciate it.
You're welcome, Peter.
You've likely noticed prices for just about everything from gas to groceries are going up as states lift COVID-19 restrictions. The Labor Department said Wednesday its consumer price index rose 4.2% in just 12 months. That's the largest gain since the financial collapse of 2008. And for more on what's happening here, let's bring in MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi. Hi, Ali.
Good morning.
So the Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell has argued the economy is experiencing a price pop versus inflation. With that, should we be concerned by this? Should people start panicking?
Well, so it's interesting language, right? Inflation is scary. There are still people who remember the inflation of the 80s when mortgage rates were double digits and, you know, prices were getting out of control and there were fuel shortages and things like that. So it's in the Fed's interest and policymakers' interest not to worry too much or not to say too much to alarm people about inflation. The concept of a price pop is that there are prices that have increased probably for the short term because there have been a combination of supply disruptions because of COVID and the fact that people are now starting to get out. There's an increased demand for travel, for eating out, for buying things. And you know, with the vaccinations, people are getting out there. Restaurants and businesses haven't fully been able to supply up yet. So he's saying this is a temporary dislocation. It should end up fine. He's also said, and this is important, that when there's inflation, the Federal Reserve has a remarkable tool for inflation. It's interest rates, right? Interest rates, when you lower them, it puts the gas on the economy. It makes it more active. And when you need to slow it down, you increase interest rates. And because it costs people money to borrow at that point, they slow down on their spending, demand goes down, and inflation goes down. So his message largely is don't get too panicked about this, but behavior in the stock market over the last few days indicates that investors are a little bit worried about this.
Okay, you broke down for us how some of these companies, the reasons why we're seeing the prices. We know that many of the prices are going up for lumber and fuel, as you said, because that has a lot to do with disruptions in the supply chain. How do wages also factor in here? I was reading that the hospitality industry, for instance, is being forced to offer higher wages to benefit benefits to attract workers, and that could be contributing to higher inflation.
Yeah, and there are a couple of things going on here. This is weird because, right, we've got 6% unemployment. Before the pandemic, we had 3.6% unemployment. So why would wages be higher now? Well, there are a few things at play. One is people are continuing to get not only unemployment benefits, but enhanced unemployment benefits. So there's an argument that a lot of people have that it's hard to get employees if they think that they might have a few more months of unemployment benefits, $300 extra per week from the federal government as a result of the last relief plan. Why give that up to work right now? Secondly, there's been wage pressure anyway. There's been, you know, this new administration is looking for a $15 minimum wage. Right now, the federal minimum wage is $7.25. A lot of major corporations have raised their wages in order to hire more people. So that's caused wages in the private sector to go up substantially. The Biden administration has just passed a law that government contractors have to pay $15 an hour. So generally speaking, wages are higher, but a lot of businesses aren't sure that their business is back yet. They're not sure about whether the lockdowns are being removed. So they're actually having trouble getting employees at the wages that they pay, and they've had to increase wages. When you increase wages, there's more money in the economy. People have more to spend. It creates more demand, and that too pushes inflation higher.
Well, also the rise in prices could be a sign that the economy is picking back up again. But with so many people unemployed and struggling, what matters to just about everyone is how long these high prices will actually last. Is there an answer for this?
Well, some of the things that are really affecting people, first of all, because of this pipeline that was shut down, we're starting to see gas prices go up in a few places. That should adjust itself. automobiles, there's this microchip shortage all over the world. So electronics in general, but cars specifically, are a lot higher. Now, somebody who's struggling may not be looking to buy a new car, but because new car prices are so high, used car prices have gone up as well. So remember, when you think of a basket of goods, which is how we calculate inflation, a car is a very big part of a basket if someone's looking to buy it. So there are all sorts of things. The reason Jerome Powell says it's a blip is because some of these things should even out over the course of the next few months. But it's across the board. You're seeing increases in food and consumer staples. And for a while, for people who either haven't been making money, are depending on government assistance, or haven't got their job back, it makes it very, very hard to live.
That's MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi. As always, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
The WNBA begins its 25th season tomorrow, and tonight ESPN premieres a documentary on the league's tumultuous 2020 season. First of all, that season was shortened. 12 teams of 12 players, along with coaches and trainers, agreed to seclude themselves in a COVID bubble in Bradenton, Florida. But were they cut off from the world? No, not by any stretch. The WNBA players were deeply involved in the Black Lives Matter protests that were roiling the rest of the country. The documentary is called 144, after the number of players in the bubble. And joining me now are the film's co-directors, Lauren Stowell and Jenna Contreras. Welcome to you both.
Well, hi. Hello. Thanks for having us.
Oh, happy to have you. And Jenna, I do want to start with you, because to make this film, you had to go into the bubble with the players. What was that like?
Yeah. So, you know, I got the call, you know, late in July of sports were coming back. There was going to be a WNBA season, and it was going to take place in a bubble. And, you know, this was kind of, you know, back in July, the height of coronavirus. We didn't really know what a bubble was, now that we know it so well. There was no talk of a vaccine. So there was a lot of unknown variables. Because of COVID restrictions, we were limited to only being able to send myself, one camera operator named Joshua Smith, and one audio tech named Morgan Worth. And so the three of us, you know, kind of just catapulted down to Bradenton, Florida. And, you know, we had a week of quarantine before we got on a plane, and then a week of quarantine before we were actually allowed into the site with the players. So when we were there, we were kind of, you know, on the same wavelength of what the players were doing. We were taking coronavirus tests every single day. We were eating the same food they were eating in the dining rooms. We were staying in the same lodging areas, you know, like we couldn't leave this campus.
Did it feel safe?
You know, it did. It was almost this weird safety, because you knew that coronavirus, for the most part, was not a factor to worry about. And even because we had something to do every single day, there was a schedule, we kind of got to decompress a little bit from the news cycle.
Well, imagine how the players felt if it was uncertain for you. Here's WNBA Players Association President Nneka Egumike, who's a player on the LA Sparks.
There was concern around coronavirus. There was concern around the intricacies of not playing for 5 months and then being asked to play. There was concerns around the length of training camp. There was concerns around pre-existing conditions, high-risk players to coronavirus. And, I mean, there were so many concerns.
What were the challenges like for the players? Because it was probably physically exhausting to do this.
Oh, yeah.
In the middle of a pandemic.
Right. Yeah. You know, outside world, if you're not an athlete, you're just excited that sports are coming back, right? But I think what was really, you know, kind of underestimated of what the impact would be was the mental toll on these players. These women, they are, you know, at the top of their game in one of the hardest professional leagues to make, but they didn't sign up to play in a single site in a bubble. They didn't sign up to perform every other day.
And what was it, 22 games in 50 days?
Yes. So they were playing 22 games in 50 days every other day. And then you also have to practice. You also have to consider rehab and therapy for any players of, you know, just keeping their bodies and mind fit. These coaches had to change the entire way they've known to coach, because they had to just save the bodies.
And look, let's be clear here. That's not even the most important part of this story. Lauren Stowell, we know what was happening as this season was opening. Breonna Taylor had been killed by police in Louisville, Kentucky. George Floyd had been murdered in Minneapolis. 80% of the WNBA players are black, and many of them identified with what was happening in this country. Here's Natalie Achunwa on the Indiana Fever. Let's listen.
It really hits home because it could have been me. And that's the hardest part. It's like, it doesn't matter. At the end of the day, I take off this jersey, I'm still a black woman. So that's where the fight comes from. That's where the passion comes from. Because it could have been me.
What kind of statement were these players making by showing up in this time?
Yeah, I mean, you can hear it there from Natalie. You know, what Jenna discovered as soon as she started doing interviews was that for a league, you know, majority black women, they had one unifying, you know, goal, and that was to get justice for Breonna Taylor. That was the reason that every player wore her name on their jerseys. And that was, you know, Peter, very real for them.
Was that the real point of this season, the activism and not so much the basketball?
I think it was both. I think that, you know, as we were speaking about earlier, there was this feeling of sports returning and the importance of not missing the season. But beyond that, it was so much bigger than basketball. Every player expressed to Jenna that the platform was important. In this time in America, what everyone was going through, the events that were taking place, the injustices that we were seeing unfold in real time on the internet, it was the reason that they felt the responsibility to take a stand on that platform with the national coverage that they would get by playing.
Right. And the events didn't stop as the season progressed, because in August, Jacob Blake was shot 7 times by police in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And the WNBA players joined the men in the NBA who refused to play several games in protest. And I was surprised watching this film how difficult a decision that was for the players.
Yeah, I mean, I know Jenna can speak to this too. The emotions, as you see in the film, were raw and really unfiltered. There was a lot of conversation. There was a lot of dialogue that took place, not only in the decision to play, but as you saw in the film, also in the decision of what to do next and whether there was, you know, a bigger purpose to what they were doing and how they would make the 2 days that they stopped playing, how would they would make that impactful.
Well, some of the debate, as you just said, was heated. Here's Courtney Williams of the Atlanta Dream. She's speaking at a private all-players meeting.
I'm not willing to give up my check because that's the only reason why I'm here. We decided to come in here and dribble a ball and make our voice be heard. So now we decide we don't want to dribble no ball no more, and now we lose our platform, and now what? Now we're living like boo-boo fools.
Jenna, I assume you were there in that meeting. What did you make of that moment? And I don't know for sure, but I'm pretty certain the men in the NBA weren't having the same kind of conversations about money when they made their decision.
Right. You know, what's so special about the WNBA is that everything that they do, every single move that they make, is so thoughtful and intentional and educated. And in that meeting, you know, these are real life issues that they have to worry about. You know, we know about the pay discrepancy problem between professional men's leagues and women's leagues. So this was a real, real conversation of, if we don't play, how are you going to pay your mortgage the next day? How are you going to be able to feed people and your family?
Yeah.
These were real problems that people that aren't professional athletes have to deal with in some type of way. And I think it was important that you see a league of women that are from different backgrounds, from different walks of life, come together and be able to explain their different point of views, take all that information, and then figure out what is best for everyone.
I find it almost remarkable that the sort of the season goes on, right? The playoffs happen. The Seattle Storm, they end up winning the championship. And it was such an abnormal season. What did it feel like for the players who won? Did winning the trophy at the end of all of that come with the same kind of satisfaction?
I'd have to say it probably came with a little bit more, right? You know, these women had the world stacked on their shoulders while trying to perform every night, trying to enact change. Some of them trying to parent from the bubble with their children there or from the bubble when their children weren't there. And through everything that was going on, they're still there to uplift one another. And that takes a lot of strength. And so I think, you know, there's a great scene in the documentary when in the Storm locker room where they just are screaming like, we're going home. And there's just this moment of elation of it's kind of hitting them that they have conquered everything that they wanted to do. Like, yes, they wanted to come and perform and win a championship. But, you know, they also wanted to hopefully plant some seeds and enact some change. And so it just, this, it doesn't, I don't think you could ever compare what this season is compared to any other championships.
Hmm. Lauren, what do you think the impact of this wild, unconventional season was, not only on the league and on the players, on the fans? I mean, did it make a difference?
I would like to believe it did. I think that, you know, the circumstances of them being there, having 144 players in one place, it yielded a result that I think even watching it, you know, closely, it was unexpected for me to see how they were stronger together than they were as individuals. And I think that if they had had a season in a normal fashion where, you know, city to city, a traveling tour, it would not have been the same impact of having them all there sharing one experience with one goal. And I think that that message became, you know, a message of unity that was really what we needed. I think we needed it then, and I hope that it's going to be a message of unity that resonates with people right now as we try to put one foot in the front, you know, in front of the other as a country and move forward and become less divided and more, you know, united. That's what I hope.
Lauren Stowell and Jenna Contreras are co-directors of the new documentary 144. It's about the shortened 2020 WNBA season. Fine work of filmmaking and journalism. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Today, it seems like everybody's got a bone to pick with the news. So it happens when somebody stops talking smack and just decides to wage all-out war.
First thing you do in an invasion, you eliminate the communications of the enemy.
And what happens if they win? Visit Stockton, California, for a story about a revolt against the mainstream media that's shaken up a city. From NPR's Invisibilia.
The Italian island of Lampedusa was a flashpoint in the global migrant crisis in 2015, and history may be repeating itself now. More than a dozen boats packed with hundreds of migrants have reached the island in recent days, and they're being detained there now. The BBC's Mark Lowen was on the island this week, and Mark, what did you see there?
Well, Tanya, there's been an uptick, really, in arrivals over the last few days. Since Saturday alone, more than 2,100 migrants have arrived in Lampedusa. Let me just paint the picture of the island for those who don't know. It's a very small island, just 6,000 permanent inhabitants, sort of midway between the rest of Sicily in southern Italy and North Africa, but it's actually closer to the North African coast. So it's long been a gateway to Europe, but it is an island that is under pressure when there are migrant arrivals. And the migrant camp there to which the arrivals are sent was originally designed to hold about 300 people. It's now got about five times the number. And we watched as very frightened migrants were on the port at night, then taken to the migrant camp. We watched another tugboat come in with another group that were picked up. But it's unclear exactly really how many people are being sent back.
I want to delve into why we're seeing this influx of migrants, but you had a moment where you were able to talk with some of them. You were told that you couldn't speak with them, but you spoke to them from inside the fences that surround where they were detained. Let's listen.
I want to walk. I want to feed my family. They are dying. I lost about four sisters, all because of hunger.
This woman says to you that she lost four sisters. Where are these people coming from and why this surge of refugees now?
They come directly to Lampedusa from Libya, but actually most of them are not Libyan. They are from as far afield as Bangladesh. The lady you heard there is from Nigeria. And in terms of why the numbers have picked up now, it's sort of hard to tell. I mean, it's certainly helped by better weather. That said, it is still a perilous crossing. It takes about 3 days, and they pay the traffickers some $1,800 to get there. There is speculation that this could be an attempt by the Libyan government to try to extricate some money from the European Union. But ultimately, this is the work of the traffickers who shamelessly send these people to Europe, basically knowing that they are going to be deported back when their asylum claims fail.
And you mentioned this is a perilous trip. I mean, more than 500 people have died and many have drowned on this journey. This was a serious problem for Italy a few years ago when the migrant crisis was at its peak. How is the government dealing with what's happening right now?
Well, the government here in Italy now is a national unity government, which comprises left-wing parties, but it also comprises far-right anti-migrant party called the League. This influx of migrants into Lampedusa has put pressure on the unity of the government, because the League has been talking about how there is a need for a naval blockade, while the left-wing parties in the coalition are obviously more pro-migrant and less hard-line on this issue. So it is a very, very tricky issue, and it is something that the EU is still grappling with 6 years on from the peak of the migrant crisis, as you say, when 1 million people made it into the European Union from the Middle East and from Africa.
Mark, thank you so much for this update.
Pleasure talking to you, Tanya. Thanks.
That's the BBC's Mark Lowen. Here and Now listeners know Jamal Simmons as one of our Democratic political strategists. He's also the author of a recent essay addressing what he calls the 4% problem and the lack of Black leaders in our institutions. And he joins us now. Hey, Jamal.
Hi, how are you, Tanya?
I am well. So you've said in nearly every sector, Black inclusion stalls at about 4%, and you say that's not enough. Give us an example of what that looks like.
Yeah, so Tanya, what I started looking at after the George Floyd and Breonna Taylor murders is I started to take a look at all the statements that were coming out from all these companies and organizations that wanted to do something and tackle systemic racism. And the question began to appear to me whether or not these companies have the teams at the table who can actually deal with this problem. Are they really fully equipped to take on this challenge? So I looked at leadership at these most pivotal institutions. Let me just tell you one quick story. When I was at Harvard grad school, I was at the Kennedy School, and we had a student action. We called the leadership in to talk about the fact there were no Black tenured faculty at the school. Now, that was 25 years ago. Today, there are 2 Black faculty at the school out of 55. Mm. So in 25 years, the pipeline only produced 2 more people than it had in 1996. That's just not enough. That 4% problem is not enough. And so it's 3.6% at the Kennedy School, 3.5% at Harvard more broadly. Those numbers tended to kind of keep coming back at me at UVA and at Yale and University of Michigan and University of California, Berkeley. It didn't seem to matter geographically where you looked. The numbers kept coming.
Well, as you point out, this problem doesn't exist because there's a shortage of leadership candidates, though. I mean, you talk to a lot of experts. Why do you think the 4% problem continues to exist?
Well, one thing that happens is people begin to perceive more diversity than exists if there's a high-profile person of diversity that's present. So, for instance, Colin Powell was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the 1990s. Again, that was over 25 years ago. People often talk about the military as being the most egalitarian part of our society. The military is now 43% people of color. It's 17% African American. But of the 41 commanders in all 4 branches who could possibly be chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, there are only 2. 2 out of those 41 who are African American. That's 4.9%. So what happens is when we see that person there, we think that we're more diverse than we are.
I know this is an obvious thing, Jamal, but I'm just thinking about even something so small as, you know, on the front brochure or page of anything, when you have like a group of people and you have a black person, what mm-hmm. you're saying to the world is like, we promote diversity. We're a diverse place, even though on the back end of that, it might not be the case. And I think an institution would say, well, we do that because we're trying to say to other people of color, you're welcome here. But what it actually is doing is giving a false sense that there actually are people there.
Absolutely. And actually, it's even worse. There is evidence. There's evidence that one of the things people do is as a coping mechanism is people of color whiten up their resumes. So they may take off the fact that they were the head of the Black Student Association at University of mm-hmm. Wisconsin. But if they see in the job announcement, diversity encouraged, you know, looking for people of color, whatever the language is, people say that gives you the cue, like, oh, we want more diversity. So people won't take the Black Student Association thing off their resume. But the recruiters are still operating with the same discriminatory mindset. So imagine it like this. Imagine a parking lot, and there are 100 spaces in the parking lot. You number all those spaces, 1 through 100. Around space number 4, you'll see a cluster of cars, right? So it's not exactly a ceiling. It's just this cluster that seems to happen mm-hmm. around space number 4. And we see it in the C-suite. We see it in corporate boards. Amazon has this problem. Venture capital. If you start to go through the most pivotal institutions in American society, it just keeps coming back again and again, around 4%.
Well, you're actually calling for something called a stage integration. And you acknowledge that some people might find this controversial. What exactly is staged integration?
So we've been at this integration game for over 50 years, right? We've been doing it since the 1960s. And if it's only yielding 4% African-Americans in the leadership of the most pivotal institutions, something's not working. So my argument is we need to maybe look at this a little bit differently. And instead of betting on superheroes to make it through big institutions and corporations and, you know, that are tilted against them, where there are not that many people for them to emulate, perhaps what we should do is laterally transition people into these organizations now. So let's stage them so that they can come in where it matters. Starting at the beginning, you know, in tech does most of its recruiting at 5 schools. And those mm-hmm. 5 schools in 2019 only had 24 black graduates in computer science combined, all 5 of them. University of Maryland, Baltimore County, which is led by Freeman Hrabowski, who's African-American president of the school, they had over 80 black computer science graduates. North Carolina A&T had over 40 black computer science graduates alone. So maybe the answer isn't just to keep doing things the way we have always done them, but to go find people where they are.
There was that program, though, at Google where they partnered with Howard University and students spent time on the Google campus. And while they've hired from that program, it didn't actually bore out the numbers expected, right?
Yeah, that informs my thinking, right? Because it may be that there is an institutional bias that exists here. The reality is Google doesn't recruit from Georgia Tech, let's say. It's one of the most mm-hmm. renowned institutions in the world. But if you have a founder and a team that's already building a product, is already working on ideas, you can now, it's not that big of a risk to bring them in. Now you've invested in them, you've worked with them, you've seen what they can do. You can bring them into the company from that position of leadership they had in their former company and not just bring them in fresh out of school.
Can you talk a little bit more, though, on how this will work? Because how might these institutions you're talking about work together to kind of make this pipeline work?
So I talked to Melissa Harris Perry, who was at MSNBC for a long time, one of the first black hosts, and also Reverend Al Sharpton. When they had their show, they particularly went out to find black pundits, black producers, to make them a part of their show. When Melissa Harris Perry left the network, Joy Reid took her position, African-American woman. She also made this a priority. So not all of these black-led organizations are black-owned. But what you see is black leaders tend to nurture new black talent. And we should be going to those black leaders to find that talent and reward them for their work in sourcing that talent, developing that talent into leadership of American institutions.
The operative word there is reward, because that can also be a lot of labor.
Absolutely. And here's the thing. You've got to reward them, because what you don't want to have happen is what's happened in the past. Companies and organizations come around, they cherry pick new talent from black-led organizations. They leave that black-led organization bereft of that talent. But if you're doing this as a staged process, as a formal relationship, maybe there's an exchange process that happens for some period of time. And then what you'll start to see is everybody benefits. The pipeline continues to grow. Darren Walker, who's now the president of the Ford Foundation, one of the biggest foundations in the world, he was at the Abyssinian Development Corporation in Harlem before he came there. This is a pipeline that already exists.
Well, you ask if executives really want more Black leaders at the table, and you say probably not. Why and how do you break that cycle?
So I spent a lot of time talking to professors at business schools, and one of the things that comes up is this question of what they call prototypicality threat, that people think that their experience is the defining experience of any organization. So the idea of hiring somebody and bringing them in who doesn't fit their prototype can be discomforting. But we've got to be willing to change the culture, because as America changes, we're going to need to have new people at the table who do business differently. The world looks a lot more like America's going to look as we become a more diversified nation. But right now, this 4% has been operating almost like a unconscious tipping point, like in residential housing, where if it gets beyond a certain point, people begin to leave or they get a little nervous. So we've got to challenge it. We've got to tell the truth about it. And then we've got to look for some strategies to try to disrupt that 4% and get American organizations and companies and law firms and military, all these folks. We've got to get people comfortable with having more Black people around the decision-making table.
Jamal Simmons is a Democratic political strategist whose piece, The 4% Problem, appears in Democracy, a journal of ideas. Jamal, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And let's get an update on the pandemic in Southeast Asia, where the virus is surging in several countries. In Vietnam, thousands of people are in quarantine. And in Thailand, infections that numbered less than 10,000 at the end of last year now top 90,000. NPR's Michael Sullivan is in Chiang Rai, Thailand. Michael, welcome. Good to speak with you.
Hi.
And how would you describe the pandemic there where you are right now? Is it getting out of control?
Where I am in Chiang Rai province, we've been pretty lucky so far. Confirmed cases here are barely in the double digits, and they're watching the borders pretty tight. I'm in a small town on the Mekong River, and the Thai authorities have put up a lot more checkpoints. They're patrolling the river much more carefully, and they've even put up some barbed wire in an effort to keep out people who might bring the virus in from Myanmar or Laos. But down south, way different story. Thailand today put up a new daily record in new cases, nearly 4,900, about half of which came from clusters found in two Bangkok area jails. And most of the rest of the cases are from Bangkok as well. And there are partial lockdowns there, with many businesses perceived to be high risk closed, bars, gyms, massage parlors, only takeout from restaurants, that kind of thing. And this third wave is the most deadly yet until now. Thailand had mainly escaped the worst of this pandemic by closing its borders early last year, but now it's here with a vengeance.
And is there an explanation for what's happening in Thailand? Do people think it's related to the variant?
Yeah, health officials say this wave started in late March, early April, with a cluster in some high-end nightclubs in an upscale Bangkok neighborhood. And that was it. The virus then spread very quickly, and the Thai New Year holiday was last month, with many people going home from the cities to their villages in the provinces, and that just spread it further. And authorities say many of these new cases are from the variant first reported in Great Britain, and they say it probably came here to Thailand across the porous border with neighboring Cambodia, another country that did very well in the beginning but is now struggling too.
Yeah, well, the same can be said for Vietnam. It had kept its infection rate very low, one of the lowest in the world, but now there's a spike of infections there. What's changed in Vietnam?
Pretty much the same thing that's happening here, I think, and there's a great deal of speculation that it's not a coincidence that the Cambodian outbreak, believed to have spread here, may also be responsible, at least in part, for what's happening in Vietnam. That and people smuggled in illegally from China who may have been infected as well. And I also think that after a year and change, there just might be a little COVID prevention fatigue going on in all of these countries that caused people and governments to get a little complacent. And now that, coupled with these newer, more easily spread variants, are causing a great deal of distress. But again, so far, we're talking about relatively small numbers compared to what you've seen in the U.S. and India and other countries.
I'm reading an interesting tidbit here about Hanoi, where loudspeakers that were used during the Vietnam War to warn against American airstrikes are being used again, but this time to urge people to stay vigilant during this latest outbreak. How are you seeing countries respond to these surges? How concerned are they?
They're very concerned. They're going back to the war footing that they were on at the beginning of the pandemic, sealing the borders tighter, as I mentioned, with more aggressive contact tracing and targeted testing and quarantines, in hopes they can put a lid on this thing before it's too late. And Vietnam was able to do this after a scare earlier this year, and so did Thailand, so it's not impossible, but it's going to be a lot harder this time than the last.
Well, the Red Cross is watching this very closely. It warned this week that the region is facing vaccine shortages, hesitancy, and also logistical challenges getting doses to people. What's the vaccine situation like in these countries?
It's not good. Thailand has less than 2% of the population vaccinated, Vietnam even less. Cambodia is doing a little better, and this latest outbreak in Laos, some health officials believe, may have come from that same cluster we were talking about earlier in Bangkok here in Thailand, with people coming to Laos across the porous border along the Mekong River. But the other problem is that all of these countries were late to the party in terms of organizing, in terms of ordering vaccines, and now they're trying to play catch-up at a time when many other countries, yours excluded, of course, are doing the same, and it's just a question of supply and demand, and they're on the wrong end. Thailand plans to begin producing some 65 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine next month. That should help, but the rollout of vaccines so far has really been pretty slow.
Why the hesitancy?
The hesitancy here, I think, is that because some people are just a little uneasy about getting one of the two vaccines offered here in limited supply so far, China's Sinovac and the AstraZeneca vaccine. People here have heard and seen things. I'm talking about Thailand now. They've heard and seen things about side effects from both of those that have given them pause. And the government in all of these countries, I still think, could do a lot better just selling this idea to the people that they need to get vaccinated. I think Vietnam and Cambodia are probably a little better at this than the Thais are, but I also think that the worse it gets, the more hesitant people may just change their mind if the governments don't contain these latest outbreaks, because they're just going to get more worried. And people here all around, even if they're vaccine hesitant, they're very, very worried about the spread of this.
NPR's Michael Sullivan is speaking to us from Chiang Rai, Thailand. Thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.